Thanks. It's a pleasure to be here, see lots of friends, and it's an honor to be asked to talk. And so I want to tell you about work that we've done in a sort of big collaboration on trying to solve the Hubbard model, and in particular we find striped ground states. But I want to first start with just what is the question we're trying to ask. And the initial question we had was, well, you know, first of all, how do we solve the Hubbard model? And eventually we learned that this is not really quite the right question to ask, and many of you will realize that this is true once, if you think back on the history of the field. The real question is, if you did solve the Hubbard model, how could you convince anyone that you were right? And I think people can empathize with this. And so we have our own, is this working? Okay. Our answer to this question is we combine the efforts of a number of the best competing simulation methods and try to get some sort of agreement. And if you get agreement, then that can be convincing. And if you don't get agreement, well, then you sort of know that you're in a tough situation, and you can go from there.
Steve, that's what the pollsters did. They predicted Hillary Clinton would win the presidency.
I know. I believe those pollsters too. this is under the organization of the Simons Collaboration of the Many Electron Problem, which is a group of people doing simulations in strong correlations, trying to get the sort of whole bigger than the sum of the parts. And so I want to talk about results that started under that and then sort of split off. And so I want to give a brief introduction to the Hubbard model for the sort of non-expert, and then talk about our four different powerful simulation methods, and then move on to the results, where we focused on one particular point in the phase diagram that's sort of been a key point of maximum difficulty and lots of interest, which is U equals 8 and 1/8 doping, and show our consensus on the phase of the ground state, and in particular talk about how we get stripes with nearly degenerate wavelengths. Okay, so the Hubbard model starts with the familiar Hamiltonian. We have an interaction U and a hopping T. And let me just sort of switch here to the what sort of phase diagram we might like to get. There's the T sets the energy scale, so we're really looking at one energy parameter, U over T. And then we have temperature and doping, and we, in the sort of three dimensions, we'd like to understand what the phase diagram is. And for the most part, we're not going to be talking about extra corrections you can add to the Hubbard model, such as a next nearest neighbor hopping, for example. For the high TC cuprates, typical values are U over T of about 8, doping from, say, 0 to 0.3. In that case, the typical scale of the superconducting transition temperatures is, say, J over 12 or T over 40, and say a pseudo gap sort of temperature scale would be, say, J or T over 3. Okay, and these T and U terms compete in the Hubbard model, and so the way to see the competition is to think of the hopping in terms of the bandwidth, which is 8T. And so the maximal competition you might think would be where the bandwidth is about the interaction, so U around 8T, which is where we're focusing. Now the model can be easily or more easily understood in terms of either weak coupling or strong coupling. So for small U, you can think of that there's a language, you know, we think of quasi-particles and Fermi surfaces. You look at in terms of diagrams and talk about self-energies. At the opposite limit for large U, we think of a different language. We think about exchange effects and mapping to the Heisenberg model and TJ models. These, of course, are still hard to solve. And of course, it's a little bit dicey when you really start to mix these large and small U languages and expect everything to sort of follow with both languages. So for the most part, it's going to be a little bit more useful for me to think about the sort of larger U limit. So let me just review that a little bit. So first of all, we have the origin of the exchange J comes from if two spins on two different sites connected by the hopping T are parallel, then there's no hopping. But if they're anti-parallel, you can get a virtual hopping, and this virtual process gives rise to an exchange, a lower energy for this case, with an exchange of 4T squared over U. And you can write that either as the Heisenberg at half filling or at the in terms of the TJ model. Okay, you can use this strong coupling limit to get some cartoons about how you can get pairing. It's just rough cartoons, but it's sort of instructive. So if you think of an anti-ferromagnetic background and you have a hole which might move around, say it hops two hops, the hole hops two hops to the right, it sets up frustrated magnetic bonds for all the spins that have been sort of left behind and moved over. And so that sort of shows that the hopping of a single hole is sort of frustrated. And you can fix that if you have two holes that come together and one follows it. But the other thing that can fix this sort of problem is if you have a line of holes that move sort of in a wave, that also doesn't give you any of this sort of frustration, these broken bonds. They can sort of hop together and just sort of moves the domain wall back and forth. For that to be true, they have to have a pi phase shift in the domain wall across, or one hop would give the frustration. Okay, so that's just sort of a rough cartoon picture to keep in mind. It's sort of a generic feature of these sorts of frustrated systems that when you have this sort of competition, new states can appear as a way of sort of dealing with that frustration or competition that are not directly put into the Hamiltonian. They're just a sort of clever way that the system finds to relieve this frustration. Okay, so the Simons collaboration decided that the field of simulations of the Hubbard, many different areas, but in particular the Hubbard model, was a little bit disorganized, and people would work on their method, but not really connect it very well to other methods. And so there was sort of a benchmark paper that was put together, organized in particular by Emmanuel and James LeBlanc, that tried to put everybody on the same page and using as many different techniques as we could get anybody who knew those techniques to try out. Included a wide variety of things, including things that are actually more from quantum chemistry than I usually see in physics. Okay. So we studied a wide range of doping and temperature, and we tried to connect everything to the thermodynamic limit. And so in many cases that involved extrapolation. One of the things we found was that for much of the parameter space, there was good agreement between a number of different methods. Now, there were some methods that people were trying out and they just didn't work very well at all. But there was still a collection of methods that worked for much of the phase diagram. And an example is at half filling here at U equals 8. It's a complicated figure, but there's a number of results that are coming in right, and I'm plotting the energy versus the temperature here, and there's a number of results that are, sorry, here the x-axis on the top doesn't really mean anything, it's just showing the different types of methods in one figure. But, if we look at the red x here, that's a Monte Carlo method that is actually exact because there's no sign problem at half filling, and so this is sort of a very reliable answer, and there's lots of other methods that through extrapolation get right in that ballpark. Okay, but one of the other things that we found is that the energy turns out to be a pretty good gauge of the quality of the simulation if you want to get a quick judge. It correlates with other measures of the quality of the simulation, and usually the errors in the energy were usually positive. So even though the methods weren't necessarily exactly variational, a lot of them sort of tried to get an honest estimate of the energy. So if you just got a terrible state, it would automatically have a higher energy. And so that's, for example, what's going on in these coupled cluster methods, one of the chemistry methods. Their extrapolated energies are just coming up way too high, and that was sort of typical. Okay. Now we move on to the sort of parameters relevant to the cuprates. And so first of all, there's a number of methods that are based on finite temperature. And in this curve showing the energy versus temperature, there's a cluster of methods with good agreement, excellent results at this temperature, but those methods couldn't once you threw in the fact that we were trying to extrapolate to the thermodynamic limit, these methods were not sort of going to low enough temperatures to compete with the zero temperature methods to really sort of decide what the ground state was. Okay, and then you look at, here's the zero temperature methods, and what we found there was that the best different methods gave similar energies, depending on what scale, but they gave different ground states. And so we decided, okay, so there's the finite temperature methods, the zero temperature methods, and then we decided, and a smaller group of us sort of clustered around here, decided to focus on this toughest region to see if we could resolve the differences and see what was really going on in the system. Okay, so this is the paper that eventually appeared, and this was, so we added a few people to the group. In particular, Philippe Corbeau was not in the previous effort, but he has the best IPEPS, or tensor network simulations. We also brought in Reinhard Nowak and his student Ellers, who had developed a hybrid real space momentum space DMRG, which is very nice. Okay, so there's essentially four different methods, and in some sense, in putting the whole thing together, going to the thermodynamic limit, trying to get a final answer, they all have some sort of uncontrolled errors. We don't think of DMRG as having uncontrolled errors. In that case, it's really the extrapolation that we can do a certain size cylinder, and we're extrapolating to the infinite size. Okay, so that's really uncontrolled. All the methods have some sort of uncontrolled errors. So first we have the DMRG method of the two types. Okay, then there's density matrix embedding theory, which those of you who are not familiar with it, this is sort of like a cluster DMFT, but it's entanglement-based instead of frequency-based, and does very nicely for ground state properties. The cluster is solved to reasonable sizes with DMRG, and that was developed by Garnet Chan. So this has uncontrolled errors in terms of the finite cluster size. The IPEPS method works directly in the thermodynamic limit, but it does have uncontrolled errors in the form of finite bond dimension, and there's an extrapolation that has to be done, and you know, that's uncontrolled. Finally, we have the constrained path Monte Carlo, which has a way of controlling the sine problem with a constraining trial wave function, and it turns out that the errors that you get in this particular Monte Carlo are much better than you might expect given the quality of the trial wave function, but what those errors are, though they're small, it's uncontrolled. So the key aspect of this work is that these uncontrolled errors are totally different. Some are finite size, some are extrapolations of different types or a constraint. And if we find that we get agreement among the multiple methods, then we can have a lot of confidence that we have the right answer. Okay, okay, so there was, in doing this, there was a lot of development and cross-validation between the methods that was very helpful, more helpful than we thought at first. And let me give a particular example when we were comparing between the DMRG results and the Monte Carlo results. So the DMRG is performed on cylinders, and the difficulty increases exponentially with the cylinder width. So for width 4, it's nearly exact. For width 6, it's very precise. And width 8, all of a sudden, it's sort of out of reach. The Monte Carlo has this constraint error that seems to be surprisingly small, but there's no internal determination of the size of the error, and it's very hard to improve on that constraint systematically. So as a cross-validation, we check the Monte Carlo error with the DMRG on the small systems, And then the Monte Carlo can go to somewhat larger cylinders, say up to 8 to 12. And then we can learn that we trust the Monte Carlo on those larger cylinders and also estimate an energy correction of what the how much the trial state is making, how big an error it makes. Okay, but in fact we found that there was a discrepancy at first. So both the methods were giving stripes, and the two some stripe states are shown up here. These are DMRG results, and so you can see the holes are showing the hole density, and you see that this has four stripes, and this has about six showing. So these are actually the same system, and it's actually two different DMRG results. And if you look at the same number of states kept, you would say that this one up here, which has half-filled stripes, is actually lower in energy. Okay, and so we thought that that was the lowest energy, but when we checked with the Monte Carlo and we were finding that they were finding these filled stripes here, we checked very carefully. What we found out was that if we look at the extrapolations that we normally do, there's a crossover in the DMRG. So initially, the filled stripes are higher in energy because they have more entanglement, and then they drop below. And if you actually compare these for the same number of states kept, you'd have to get very low beyond what we can reach before that you actually see the correct filled stripes going below the other ones. Okay, so eventually we found, oh yes, now we understand how this works, and we got agreement between all four methods. Okay, so here's results for the energy, it's a finer scale. Quite a bit smaller energy scale than we were seeing in the initial broad comparison. And we have these four different methods, and we see this sort of broad agreement within a certain energy scale. They have error bars, which are sort of internal error bars. They're not to be taken too seriously because they don't really attempt to gauge the systematic errors of, say finite size extrapolations, which are hard to judge, or the constraint. It's not trying to do that. You have to look at all four of them to get sort of a real idea of the systematic errors. The half-filled case, again, agreement within the narrow range, a smaller energy scale range. Okay, so we're getting good agreement in terms of energy. What about the states? Okay, one of the things that we can do with some methods but not the others is do comparisons within the same method of different types of states. So in DMRG, often we can't, one of the things we can't do is we can't force the system to be uniform. It just always gives you stripes of some sort. But in DMET and IPEPS, we can sort of make they each have a cluster size, and by making a small cluster, we can sort of prohibit it from making any stripes. And then we can compare the energies within those methods and say, okay, what would the energy of a uniform state be? And the states that were uniform did show D-wave pairing, but they're significantly, it's a small energy scale, but we think within our accuracy, these states are above the states with the vertical stripes. Okay, and also up here is shown a diagonal stripe. And this is for one particular point, U equals 8 and 1/8 doping. Okay. So here's some examples of the uniform states that you get, and it's a diagram that's showing sort of the mean field broken, or the sort of broken symmetry spin moment, and the hole densities in the pattern. In this case, it's uniform, so they're equal, and also the strength of the pairing by the width of these lines, and you can see they're roughly comparable in terms of the strength of the pairing for this hypothetical uniform state, but both of them have low energy states down here. Okay, another improvement, maybe some of you have been familiar with some of the IPEPS work that was showing a really close competition between uniform states and stripe states. And there was there were plots. This is Philippe Corbeau's work, and sort of stimulated by the sort of tough competition of within the group of trying to match everyone. He developed a new technique for doing these extrapolations. So over on the left, we see some of the curves are showing vertical stripes versus uniform states or diagonal stripes. And the IPEPS has a certain bond dimension that has to be taken to infinity, but you can't make it very big, and so you can try to extrapolate. And the initial extrapolations that were done were 1 over this bond dimension, which is a very rough, not really justified thing. And these are these curves shown here, which don't give very justified extrapolations. Now, in DMRG, we had been extrapolating in something called the truncation error for quite a while. It works very well, and so Philippe found out how to do that in IPEPS. And so then we get these new curves that it's the same y values, the same energies, but all of a sudden they're plotted with something different down here, and they organize much better into something that extrapolates much better. And so things can sort of sort themselves out, and you get these results down here where the vertical stripes are coming out more clearly ahead. Over here, we have the same sort of thing for vertical stripes with different fillings, different wavelengths, different ways of putting the holes into a set of vertical stripes. And those are coming out much closer in energy with overlapping error bars. And I'll say a little bit more about that. Okay, so let me give you a little bit more background on the vertical stripes and their filling and wavelength. So the sort of cartoonish picture of a vertical stripe is just a line of holes, and then the antiferromagnetism sort of skips over the line of holes. That's a pi phase shift. And if they're filled and we're at 1/8 doping, then the charge wavelength will be 8. The magnetic wavelength, taking into account the shift, the pi phase shift, is always twice this charge wavelength. And F would be this filling. It's a filled stripe. But a half-filled stripe along the line only puts a hole in every other site. And so F is 1/2 and lambda is 4. So filled stripes were found with Hartree-Fock in the late 80s. And Jan Zanon was one of the key people involved in that. But again, it's this sort of issue of convincing people that you're right. Hartree-Fock certainly may not be accurate. Half-filled stripes were found in cuprates in the mid-90s by John Tranquata and others. And so a few years later, Doug Scalpino and I worked quite a bit on simulating with DMRG the TJ model, showing that we did find half-filled stripes. And this is this simulation in the TJ model is showing a group, a bunch of holes that you put in that sort of, you put it in like they want to be in a single stripe, but they split into two. And it makes a nice sort of movie as they sort of gradually figure out that they want to be two stripes and they split apart. They have to flip all of these spins in order to make it work right, and eventually they manage to do that. We'll see in it. So they flipped all these spins so that they could make two well-organized stripes. So the case for the half-filled stripes in the TJ model was pretty clear way back in the late 90s. Okay. So here's what we're finding now for of course, the Hubbard model is not the TJ model. So this is for the Hubbard model at one particular point. And we're looking at what we can find out about the different wavelengths and the energies we get for the different wavelengths in the cases where we can try to constrain the system to have a particular wavelength, which isn't always possible. So for instance, the DMRG, it has to fit around a cylinder that we can reach. We just have a handful of points. But by putting them together with all the methods, we get sort of a, and the scales of the energy are sort of subtracted to make them bottom out at the same place. So what we're seeing is here's the filled stripes. And we see a very near degeneracy over a range of filling. And interestingly, we see an upturn in the energy in the half-filled stripes. Now, we don't have so many points here because we just couldn't get the DMRG to do that in the system sizes that we wanted. We were looking at just the width 6 system, so didn't have a point there. But you get sort of an overall picture, oh yes, there's this very close near degeneracy in the system. but it doesn't quite want to do half-filled stripes. If you look at this near degeneracy, you'd say that this is pointing towards a system with either disordered stripes or perhaps fluctuating stripes. Okay, what about pairing? So first of all, if you think about the filled stripe, it looks like an insulator. There's no carriers in it. And indeed, the results that we get for the filled stripes is no significant pairing. For the partially filled stripes, we see D-wave pairing, but it's not always completely clear. It's not 100% agreement. Most of the results show pairing. Here are some plots that are showing the pairing. What you want to be looking at, so you can see by the size of the circles that we're looking at striped states. And the top two are IPEPs, and the shaded numbers and the width of these lines here are showing the strength of the pairing. It's a smaller energy scale for the pairing and harder to measure than, say, spins or magnetic properties, but we see non-zero results here for the pairing. And for the DMET, we also see similar non-zero pairing, and here's an example from DMRG showing some pairing. I'll say a little bit more with a better example on the next slide for the DMRG. But for the DMET, there are also states that are essentially epsilon close to this one that don't really have much pairing. So it's not quite as clear cut. Okay, so for the sort of last sort of data type slide, this is a nice example that we just finished up, particularly my postdoc, Chaman Chung, looking at a system trying to see the sort of intertwining of pairing and stripes. And one of the things we like to do with our DMRG cylinders, it sort of gives a nice, almost a phase diagram in one simulation, is we vary a parameter, in this case, the chemical potential, along the position of a long cylinder. And this changing chemical potential changes the density. And so these were calculations done in the grand canonical ensemble, uncertain number of particles, so the system could spontaneously form a local pairing order. Okay, and so here we see so there's long cylinder, each sort of point is one rung of the cylinder, the chemical potential is changing, we see the density changing, and we see this oscillation. So this is stripes that have formed on the system. On the bottom, we see the strength of the local pairing, and we see a significant peak, which you look up to the density is sort of right where you might expect for optimal doping. We also see sort of a jump in the density. You know, for superconductivity, you expect to see a jump or a singularity in the density as a function of chemical potential. We're sort of seeing that here, but it's showing stripe oscillations on either side. Up here, they look more like the filled stripes, and it's got the pairing quite a bit suppressed here. Okay. So I think this is sort of a very reasonable thing to see, that the Hubbard model is showing us basically that we can have these stripes, but they don't they interact with the pairing. They don't particularly always inhibit it. You can certainly have the coexistence, but it depends sensitively on sort of what the stripes are doing. You know, if the stripes go to if they become filled, then it can suppress the pairing also. Okay, so in solving the Hubbard model, where do we stand? So first of all, in terms of sort of an energy resolution, if you look at these energy scales, it roughly corresponds to, say, about 10 Kelvin per site. So since superconductivity can occur at 10 times that, we would think that this would be enough to basically understand what, you know, ITC in some sense. The four different methods, although they have very different uncontrolled errors, they've converged to give a sort of consistent picture, but there's this near degeneracy in the results that is that, you know, if we were going to resolve that, that'd be a much lower energy scale. And at that point, if you're talking about excessively low energy scales, then the Hubbard model itself is sort of something that you really need to question strongly. In fact, at all of these energy scales, we're sort of getting consistent results, but if you add another term to the Hamiltonian, and we know there should be these corrections, T primes, etc., you're going to get different results. And what are those corrections to the Hamiltonian? Well, we have some ideas, but we don't know if they're really right. And so the question has sort of turned now towards how do we know exactly what model to simulate, because we're sort of getting some answers for a particular model, and we're seeing some discrepancies in comparison with experiments. You know, experiments are showing in many cases half-filled stripes, and we're in this particular set of parameters, we're seeing that's higher in energy by a little bit. But a slight change in the model could change that. Okay, thanks.
Well, thank you, that was really nice. To follow up on your last point, would you think that nearest neighbor repulsion or any interaction beyond Hubbard interaction would actually favor something like half-filled stripes more than filled stripes?
Yeah, so I actually have just the right... It's in my time for questions, it's not... if you think of these as just being static, and you know, of course, it could be that interactions disorder them, and you know, but if we just take them as static, we can estimate a Coulomb interaction, a long-range piece that's just an energy correction for the different types of stripe states. And so, if you try to make some sensible assumptions about dielectric constants, etc., you can translate long-range interactions as a way of shifting the energies of these states. And so, that's what's shown here. We have this energy plot that was showing lots of degeneracy here, and the no Coulomb is shown in the blue, sort of an overall result. But if you put in an estimate of the mean field Coulomb interaction from the state that was obtained for each of these cases, then you see a definite shift. So it's raising the energy of the stripes that are more filled because it's just packing more holes into the same place. And if they spread out more, it lowers the energy. And so it sort of, in this particular case, it pushed it towards 5, and it wasn't quite enough to push it to lambda equals 4. So it's certainly suggesting that that's the sort of, you know, right direction to push things, but it's again emphasizing this point that it's like you have to understand what the right Hamiltonian piece is to put in, and that's another difficult problem.
What was the diameter of the cylinder?
This was when it was not a. It was. I think this was mostly DMET, but it was not. You know, it wasn't just DMRG. We have points here that we couldn't get with DMRG because they didn't fit. You know, so it's a combination, sort of, put together.
I just had a comment on solving the Hubbard model. There also are analytic approaches.
Right.
There are all sorts of extremes, weak interaction, very close to half filling, very close to zero filling, probably very close to U equals infinity, where analytic results are possible.
Right. Right. And this whole comparison, Steve and I have had this a little bit of this conversation, this whole comparison of looking at the energies, when you're doing the analytic methods or particularly sort of traditional RG methods, you're not trying to get the energy, you're trying to get it without looking at the energy. But when you're trying to do these simulation methods, your simulation is trying to get everything right, including the energy. And the energy is sort of useful because if you get it wrong, it goes up. Whereas if things are sort of, you know, you could get, if it wasn't that, you could get it wrong with competing effects that put it right on in its order to judge other quantities.
Yeah. Although I have a comment on that too, that it's not fair to compare the energy differences to the temperature. I mean, in general, you're probably looking at something more like a condensation energy. condensation energy goes like rho of VF times TC squared.
Uh-huh.
So it's much smaller.
Okay. That's worthy of discussion.
Yeah, Steve, I wonder whether you have also noticed a slide about this one. It's a bit of a mean question. We live now in this era of quantum information, right, waiting for the quantum computer. And, you know, perhaps in all these methods, you are a bit biased with regard to the real, you know, many particle entanglement, this quantum supremacy thing. Could it be that when the quantum computer starts to buzz, that actually, because that thing can take care of the infinite party entanglement, that it will turn out that all these solutions are just wrong because in one or the other way, you've avoided to really handle that infinite party entanglement. What would you say?
Well, okay, so let me sort of translate that to the way I sort of think about it. So first of all, we can talk about the exact solution for one of these models, but Mother Nature has to sort of work hard to get the precise solution to sort of thoroughly get equilibrated, and of course we have to make the systems very clean. And so that's a sort of muddling thing, that if you sort of talk about lots of entanglement, Mother Nature may not have enough time to produce in all the entanglements that the exact ground state should have. But the other thing that I want to point out is that the Monte Carlo method, which was a key method agreeing with the others, the concept of entanglement does not enter. Since it's doing the fluctuations over all these fermion determinants, it just doesn't care about entanglements. Entanglement. So it's sort of really orthogonal to the, you know, it is true that three of the methods had entanglement as a key part of it. So we're very glad to have this fourth method with the agreement.
I know you're focusing on the ground state, but you know, as you mentioned, for example, DCA or other methods that can be very powerful at higher temperatures. I'm just curious, is there any evidence on those methods that you'd have an instability to a striped phase, or what is the current status on those methods?
Well, we worried about that for a long time, and trying to understand whether, since mostly they don't see the stripe instabilities, and whether they could see the instabilities. There's issues about sort of the being able to construct a stripe sort of with the real space representation that is given for a particular cluster. So that's a set of issues that it's a very difficult thing to set up to make work right in something like DCA. But our point of view from this was more that, you know, in terms of sort of being able to really put things together in terms of the energy scale and what temperature could be reached with things like DCA, there was still a big gap that said, okay, their energy scales are not really judging this competition. But we really do want to close that temperature gap and see what's going on as a function of temperature.
So an instability would happen below the temperature, that's what you're saying.
I think that's a reasonable thing to say.
Or they're wrong.
Steve, you had towards the end something as a function of chemical potential, so you can get that, change that to, say, doping.
Yeah.
So could you, on the board, since you didn't show us a slide of that, show us the phase diagram where antiferromagnetism, striped or otherwise of any kind, ends as a function of doping, where superconductivity is present in the ground state, where it's not present?
Okay, so I don't want to try to demonstrate my inability to recall details on the board with the phase diagram, but what we have focused particularly hard at this sort of one point in the phase diagram for this particular project that I was talking about, and in getting that right, the sort of focusing on that was sort of key. We had worked really hard on one point, and then we think we agreed. So if you then say, well, okay, if you take previous data where we didn't work so hard and look at, you know, what our estimates are, you know, then that has been done. There's, and in particular, there's been a survey of the sort of Hubbard model phase diagram with the DMET method, which was certainly the quickest method to carry out the calculations, so they could do a whole phase diagram. And certainly it gives a reasonable range of doping where you get signs of superconductivity, but I can't reproduce it from memory.
Any fireball anti-ferromagnetism end? What doping? 2%, 5%, 10%, 15%, 50%.
Well, that wasn't my work, so I can't really answer that.
Two questions, one of which is more frivolous than the other. Mm-hmm. So first is, you seem to see states that are very close together, different kinds of stripes. And how should one take that, what does one take away from that? Is it that there are tuning parameters that can allow you to see these different states? And if so, what would they be? Or is it just that one of them is wrong and one shouldn't bother about it? And the more frivolous question is, it would be wonderful if in these kinds of simulations one would see states that nobody had thought of before. After all, stripes are things that people, as you say, have thought about mm-hmm. for a long time. Mm-hmm. Have you ever come across weird and wacky things that one wouldn't just have thought of before?
Right. So. Well, let me sort of partially attack your question in a way that I have thought of, which is, fluctuating stripes. How do we, would we see if the true ground state is fluctuating stripes? What does that mean? How do you diagnose a fluctuating stripe? Would we see it in our simulations? That would be a new type of state. If we're seeing lots of near degeneracies, it certainly makes it easier for it to fluctuate. Somehow there must be a very low energy scale associated with the fluctuations. There has to be sort of a very strong sensitivity to any disorder you put in the system that makes it take one particular configuration to another. There has to be long time scales that if you put it in one sort of realization, it could flow to another. And so this sort of, so somehow though, if you think about what it means to, if in the end the thermodynamic exact expectation values say show a uniform state, how do you say it's a fluctuating stripe? Somehow in the wave function it's embedded in there, that it may not show it in a very simple measurement because it gets washed out, but if you tried to write down a variational wave function for it without putting in any sort of stripe-like correlations, you would get something that was just wrong. So that's at least some thinking along this, but in general this sort of thing is a very difficult question. So.
So as you said, knowing that the lanthanum cuprate seem to have half-filled stripes, so what additional terms in addition to this Coulomb interaction that you showed would drive towards half-filling and are realistic to the materials?
Right. Well, the key things that we thought the most about are just the next nearest neighbor hopping T prime, and because we know that's significant, we also know that potentially the second and beyond that is also significant. We know that that has a strong effect on the pairing. We don't yet know exactly how this affects the stripe filling. If you put in too big a T prime, it can just disrupt the stripes. So that's one issue, that the ones we've thought about the most but haven't done enough calculations on are the T prime and then this sort of mean field treatment of the long-range Coulomb interaction. But the fact that we see different results in the TJ model versus the Hubbard model is suggesting that the difference is there. That's a place to sort of try to understand the differences.
We have time for one more question.
I want to reiterate on Abhay's question. So there's a discussion on potential topological order in doped MOT insulators, which you can to some extent address when you put the system on a torus and look at the degeneracies of these states. Is there any indication, or has this even been looked at, that this is a viable option, an interesting option?
I think that's a very interesting place to look, but we haven't done it. Yeah, I don't know. I don't have a good estimate of whether we would be able to resolve it, but it's certainly a question that should be asked.
So,
yeah, I can't resist because Abe's question I think calls for a comment. The this workshop is called Intertwined Orders, and I think one of the really extremely unusual things which we've become used to, so used to that we don't comment on how unusual it is that this simple model without anything fine-tuned is producing a zillion different phases that are almost degenerate with each other. And that's the really unprecedented and astonishing thing that's been discovered.
Okay, that's a really good comment to add to mine, which is, first of all, to thank Steve, just to read. To reiterate what I said in my introductory comments, which is just how extraordinarily rich this field is, and with all these multitudinous phases, with fine-tuning, taking you from one to the other. And let me finish up by thanking all four speakers for a really stimulating session. Thank you.